Welcome to Sit for Speaks, the podcast for public finance professionals. Today, we're joined by Ian Murray, who is SITFA's newly appointed Director of Public Financial Management. He tells us a little bit about his career and what he hopes to achieve with his time at SITFA. We're also joined by Andy Burns, who is SITFA's Associate Director, and he'll be talking us through SITFA's Financial Resilience Index. Up first, it's Ian Murray. Today on Sit for Speaks, I'm joined by Ian Murray, who is SITFA's newly appointed Director of Public Financial Management. Hi, Ian. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Harriet. Thanks for having me along.
So first, it would be great to get to know a bit more about you. So could you tell us about your career to date and what made you enter the world of accountancy?
Yeah, sure. So I suppose let's start back at the near the beginning. So I did a history degree at university, and I came out of university, and the one thing I knew I wanted to do was work in and around the public sector. So I took a job at my local city council, Gloucester City Council, and I worked in their housing department for a while. And then the other thing I knew is that I wanted to do something with, I wanted a professional qualification, and I wasn't quite sure whether that was accountancy or a career in law, but something. So I was talking to, I had a really good boss in that job, and I was talking to him, and he said, well, what about SITFA? What about the Audit Commission? Why don't you have a look at, you know, their graduate scheme? Because that would be something that, you know, you'd be really good at. And so I did. And I applied for a trainee role at District Audit, as it was then. That's how I got into accountancy. It wasn't a choice about accountancy. It was more about wanting to work in and around the public sector. So I trained at District Audit and the Audit Commission. And then when the commission was disbanded in 2012, I moved to Grant Thornton. And then I had 10 years at Grant Thornton, which I thoroughly enjoyed. And in the last five or six of those, I was a key audit partner. So signing audit opinions. So yeah, so the accounting thing was something that I sort of fell into, but it's something that I absolutely I'm passionate about. I think as public finance professionals, we have a really, really important role to play, and frankly, that's kind of part of what prompted me to come and join SITFA the tail end of last year.
So as you mentioned, your most recent post was at Grant Thornton, which is primarily private sector. It would be great to hear a bit about the work that you did there, and also what sparked you to move back into the public sector at this time.
So at Grant Thornton, most of what I did was in audit, but working with public sector bodies, and I did a lot of work with the police sector as well. So lucky that we were at that point, the firm was doing a lot of work in terms of thought leadership and talking about what was going on in the sectors that we worked with. And so I did a lot of work in and around the police sector, particularly with the move to the creation of PCCs and some new sort of governance and accountability models. So I think in terms of what sparked the change, the public to private sector thing wasn't really a consideration, because I suppose at Grant Thornton, I, although working for a private sector body, I was working with public sector organisations. And so it seemed like quite a natural transition in that respect. But I suppose what sparked the change was just a sense that, you know, having had a really good stint at Grant Thornton, it was a thought about, well, could I go and do something different for the tail end of my career, which might have an impact in a different way? And, you know, and I suppose stepping out of my comfort zone ever so slightly, or entirely in some cases, and do something different. So I think the driver has always been about, for me, as purpose. It's always been about doing something where you feel you have an opportunity to have an impact and to change things in a positive way. And I felt that the opportunities to do that somewhere like SITFA were maybe a bit different to the ones that were present at Grant Thornton at the time. And I think, being really honest, some of the world of local audit, I don't think this is a surprise to anyone, the role of local audit has changed somewhat over the sort of the last 10 years. And I think some of the things that excited me about the role when I was doing it for the first time were, I suppose, less relevant or less prevalent in the role, and it had changed somewhat. So yeah, it was a very personal decision. But the key thing for me was being able to work in and around the sectors that I'm passionate about, and hopefully do that in a way that makes people's lives a bit better.
Great. And it sounds like you were aware of SITFA kind of since the very beginning of your career as well.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm a SITFA member, and I trained as a SITFA, and the sort of the qualification and the profession, that was something that really, really appealed to me. So CFO has been a big part of my professional life. And again, coming across to work for the Institute felt like a very natural next step.
Great. And your role at CFO is going to be Director of Public Financial Management. So could you tell us a bit about what that's going to involve?
Yeah, so I suppose we've just refreshed our business plan. And in the business plan, we have ambition around our voice. And a lot of that ambition will sit with me and the PFM team. Really want to make sure that, I think CFO does some fantastic work, and I just want to make sure that the fantastic work that we do, that we're able to have impact with that, that we're able to amplify our voice in a way that we're talking about things that matter, and in a way that has impact, I suppose, is the way that I would frame it. I suppose specifically day to day, there are sort of four broad parts of it. So there's the team that do the standard settings, so the government code and the charity SORP and all the bits of technical guidance that we produce mainly for local government. There's the policy team, so that's very much about Sit for Thinks. So some of that's responding to immediate things that are going on in the sector in terms of either how we apply policy or how we help shape policy, those sorts of things. Some of that will have a longer term horizon and will be more, I suppose, blue sky in that respect. The networks teams, so we're on a number of networks. So I suppose looking at how we create communities of practice, how we support practitioners with tools, advice, and make sure that they're armed to do their work and to deliver, and then bits of communication, so particularly some of those that are sort of outward facing, and again sort of tying that back to voice and really using that in a way that allows us to take the good work that we do and the insight and advice that we can provide and make sure that we get that to as many audiences and stakeholders in a way that helps and supports them in their professional careers.
Fantastic. And what are your kind of specific aims and hopes for your time at CFO? Is there anything in particular that you would like to focus on?
So I think sort of going back to the last answer, really, there's making sure that what we talk about is relevant and that we do that in a way that has impact. I think that there are, for me, there's a balance to be struck between those things which we need to be supporting public finance professionals with now or talking about now because they're very immediate and present in everyone's minds, and that's really important. But I'm really, one of my concerns would be that generally as a society we think quite short term at the moment, and I think one of the things I also want us to do as CFO is start to make sure that we're helping people to lift their heads to the horizon slightly and see the things that are coming down the line. So I suppose in the very medium term, we know that at some point the current parliament that we have will, if we don't have an election this year, then we will have to have one towards the end of next year because this parliament will be at the end of its life. So how do we help shape the agenda of the next parliament? And I think that's something which we have we're really well placed to be able to do. And I think increasingly, the conversation about how do we safeguard society, resources, all of those things for future generations. So whether we're talking about net zero or sustainability, that's something which I think the public sector is probably slightly behind the curve on, but is a really, really important conversation. And I'd like to put CFO at the centre of that in the public sector. A really important opportunity there for us to shape what all of that looks like, and again start to build those communities of practice around what will be. New ground. So we'll be looking at not just what needs to be disclosed, but how do you go about producing that information? And a really important piece there, I think, just again linking back to purpose. So yeah, there is lots and lots that we can and will get involved with. But I really want to make sure that we're striking that balance between the short and the longer term, and helping to make sure that whilst we deal with what's going to be an uncomfortable period, I think, for public finance in the UK and globally, that we don't lose sight of some of those important things that are easy to forget or dismiss because they have a longer term horizon.
You mentioned there that everybody's kind of thinking in the short term at the moment, and I think there's a lot of turmoil in the public sector. So what's your impression of that, and what kind of changes do you feel that we need to make in order to ease that situation?
So I think this is a really difficult one because it is easy to be negative. But it's also understandable why people are negative, because the situation is is difficult. And obviously, as a country, we are in a, you know, we've had a number of sort of external shocks, haven't we, with the COVID pandemic, and we've got, you know, a war in Europe, and all of those things have either triggered cost of living crisis and all of those things that we're all experiencing day to day. And you know, linked with that, through austerity, there has been a tightening of public finance, and that's, you know, that's been difficult for everybody to. So I suppose we found ourselves in a position where there's been a degree of disinvestment in public services, and then these external shocks have come, and we're not we're not collectively in a place where, if we're going through another period of austerity or reduced government funding, we're not in the position that we were when austerity Mark One happened. So it's a completely different environment. And so there is going to be a bit of grin and bear it, I suppose. The plus side to that is, I think there is a sense that things cannot continue the way that they currently are. And there are a number of perennial issues, particularly if we just looked at it from a UK perspective, there are a number of perennial issues which I think we've as a society talked about and we've tried to tackle, but we've not necessarily done that particularly successfully. And I wonder whether some of what's coming will create a bit of a burning platform for things, for some of those issues to be I suppose for a broader conversation about how some of those so things like health and social care integration is always an issue. We have real challenges in children's services at the moment, particularly for some of the most vulnerable children who have special educational needs. These aren't problems that, as a civilized society, we should tolerate or allow to fester for any longer than they already have. So that you sort of chunk all those things together, and is there a point coming where, as a society, we have a conversation about, well, how big a public sector do we want, and what do we want that public sector to do for us, how could some of that public sector work better, and then if we take all of that in the round, what is it that public sector would need in terms of resource to be able to do everything that's asked of it? Because I do feel at the moment we probably have, we have service levels and service expectation from population which just aren't appropriately funded in lots of cases, and that's not a sustainable position. So it may provide an opportunity for some of those bigger conversations. And I suppose, going back to the comment I made earlier, that we know at some point we'll have a new parliament, whatever political persuasion, we don't know that bit, but there is an opportunity for us to start to reshape some of that and re-ask some of those questions. But yeah, the difficulty is that I think in the short term there are going to be some really difficult decisions that people make. And so in the short term, what I'd like us to see is, what I would see our role to sit for is, well, it's supporting our practitioners, supporting our members as they do their role in difficult circumstances, making sure that they can deliver that in a professional way, that we don't lose sight of good governance as we go through that process, and that hopefully we come out the other side of that in as good a shape as we possibly can, but also acknowledging that all of that is very easy to say, and a lot of that is really hard to do in practice.
So lots of challenges coming up, but kind of reframing the negative situation more into an opportunity of what we can do.
Yeah, I think absolutely, trying to see the opportunity in that. And, you know, the COVID pandemic wasn't anything that we would have, as a society, we would have chosen to go through. People losing their lives and all of those, people having to curtail their freedom, all of those things are not things that we would, but some of the good things that came out of that was actually how public sector or how public services in the UK were able to respond to that, the role of local government in terms of being able to act as that conduit between central government and businesses. A lot of those barriers between care, health and care systems were, quickly dissolved. And so I suppose in that moment of crisis, you can kind of, we understood, I think, as a society, how important having good public services is to us. And I suppose, there may be then, if we were going through a similar point of crisis, or they're less acute, could we look at how that might enable some of the same behaviours, or enable some of the same thinking about how you break down barriers and how you start to do things differently? If you continue to try and achieve the same set of outcomes with the same systems and processes, and they continue to not deliver those outcomes, then at some point you have to go back and ask yourself the question, well, is it that we're just not doing this in the in the right way.
Great. Well, I think that's a brilliant place to end. Thank you so much for joining us today on Sit for Speaks. It was great to talk to you.
Thanks very much for having me along. Thank you, Harriet.
That was Ian Murray, SITFA's newly appointed Director of Public Financial Management, telling us about his career and what made him want to enter the world of accountancy. Up next, we'll hear from Andy Burns, SITFA's Associate Director.
Hi, Andy, and thanks for joining us today on SITFA Speaks. You are the Associate Director at SITFA, but what does that involve exactly?
Good morning, Mark. Yeah, so my job as Associate Director means that I lead for SITFA on local government, particularly in its relationships with some of the key stakeholders in the sector, local authority finance directors and treasurers, the Local Government Association, National Audit Office, and other key players in the sector. I also do some advisory work around good governance.
Late last year, we released the 2022 edition of our Resilience Index, which is a project you are very much involved with. It's an analytical tool that compares the financial position of local authorities, which is designed to be used by chief financial officers. Obviously, in the past year, we've seen quite a few local authorities in precarious financial positions, and some have issued something known as a Section 114 notice. These include Thurrock, Croydon and Slough councils. A common misconception is that Section 114 notice means a council has gone bankrupt, but this isn't actually the case, is it?
No, it's not. And I guess shorthand to try to explain to the public who might not understand preventative action when usually a council projects or foresees that it will have insufficient income in order to fulfil the costs of running its day-to-day activities. There are actually a couple of other technical reasons for a 114 notice. One is a council might be about to undertake illegal expenditure, or sometimes it might not have sufficient money to fund its capital expenditure plans. But in the context in which it's usually been talked about in recent times, it usually means a council's projections undertaken by their chief finance officer are that the income they expect to get will be insufficient to fund its day-to-day activities, and therefore action needs to be taken, which usually includes putting in place spending controls to buy some time until a plan for recovery is put in place.
I guess it's technically impossible for a council to go bankrupt in the most common understanding of the term.
Well, I guess that probably hasn't been tested to the nth degree. Usually, because it's a public authority, it can be underwritten by the ability to raise taxes or indeed to get support from government. But I think in the traditional sense of bankruptcy being unable to pay its debts, we haven't yet had a situation where a council has been in that position. So it probably is technically impossible to go bankrupt, but never say never.
This year's Resilience Index has taken place against a backdrop of significant political and economic turmoil, the cost of living crisis and global uncertainty. One of the main findings of the index was that local authorities have increased their reserves to $31 billion from $29 billion in 2020-2021. Can you talk about why they have done this and why it's significant?
Yeah, I think there'll be a number of reasons for that. And some people might think it's counterintuitive that councils have done that when we hear that they're under financial pressure. But reserves are usually a proxy for risk. The greater risk that a council faces, the more it needs reserves to cope with the uncertainty arising from those risks. I think there are some particular features around this resilience index, which some of it flows from the, as we came out of the COVID pandemic, the government gave councils many grants, particularly grants they were to pass on to local businesses at the end of the March 22 financial year. And the money was given to councils, but the councils would have had plans to spend that early in the new financial year. So that might have held those for a short period of time, rather than for a longer period of time. In addition, councils, when they set their budgets back in February 22, would have had unforeseen additional costs of inflation and energy increases and additional demands for services. So some of the reserves are being held to fund some of those costs. I guess the other point to make here about resilience and reserves is that reserves are just one dimension of resilience, but there are a range of other things that indicate how resilient or sustainable a council's finances are, and that includes how predictable and buoyant its income streams are, the extent of the cost and demand pressures it faces, and also some of the judgments that are made by inspectors or auditors which might have an impact on the council's need to spend resources. But I think the index showed this year, I think, was a short-term picture at a point in time at the end of the year but we remain concerned about the medium and longer term outlook for local government finances, which still are uncertain and risky. And a Section 151 officer or chief finance officer in that context will be thinking, actually, because of that risk and uncertainty, particularly about future income streams, we need to set aside some resources to manage those risks which may arise.
The index also reveals the proportion of local authorities who are spending more on social care this year compared to last year has actually increased. These increases in social care spending will obviously have impacts on other non-statutory services. What's behind the increase in social care spending, and what potential impacts are you concerned about?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question, and just an interesting feature of one of the dimensions of resilience I just mentioned. So firstly, social care, there's adult social care, which is for people who are elderly and people with disabilities, and also children's social care, usually children sort of at risk or in need of intensive support. And the demand for each of those services has increased significantly over a number of years. Social care is, as your question suggested, an increasing proportion of their total spend. And in many cases, it's between 2/3 and 3/4 of total spend. Now, because there are statutory responsibilities associated with adults and children's social care, and also a statutory responsibility to balance the budget, councils have to fund that statutory responsibility, which means there's fewer resources available for all of the council services. So the universal services like highways or leisure or the environmental or place-based services, in order to balance the books, councils have had to make efficiency savings or indeed cuts in some of those areas. There have been some additional government resources to fund some of the social care pressures, but they have been, I think, short term in their nature. There's been some additional grants. Some councils have the ability to raise a further precept, 2% of the council tax for social care to fund some of this. What the sector really needs is long-term solutions for both adults and children's social care pressures. And at the moment, we've had a series of one-off short-term grants or ability to raise council tax, and the sector and indeed SEPRA have been calling out for longer term sustainable funding and reform to enable councils' social care responsibilities fulfilled without jeopardising the need to spend on important sort of place-based services, which during the pandemic was shown are really important to the sort of the prosperity and well-being of places.
The index obviously takes place against the backdrop of soaring inflation, which is affecting everyone at the moment around the world. The index looks at local authorities' debts and the level of borrowing. While the level of debt itself isn't necessarily an indicator of immediate risk, it may, however, limit the flexibility of a local authority to remain financially resilient. The index finds that total debt for most local authorities has actually decreased, indicating that councils have borrowed less in the 2021-2022 period. Why do you think they have borrowed less? But because of soaring interest rates, they'll still need to be mindful of their already existing debt, won't they?
Maybe first thing, just to explain the reason councils have debt. It's normally to fund capital expenditure. So when councils built schools or care homes or enhanced highways, built libraries, they would have borrowed the money in order to do that and paid for it over a long period of time, because you're creating assets which have a useful life. So the reason councils' debt will have fallen recently is during the pandemic, many people paused their capital investment programs because of capacity issues or uncertainty, and actually, but they would have probably still been repaying some of the older debt from previous capital expenditure. So that's the first thing to say. The second thing to say is most councils, when they borrow to fund capital expenditure, well, they take out loans for a long time period. So interest rates rising in the short term wouldn't necessarily have an impact on past capital expenditure. If that persists, that might mean that councils are less able to afford future capital expenditure, or maybe might have to minimise the amounts of capital expenditure they would undertake. Now, SIPA have some separate guidance about capital expenditure and borrowing to fund it being needing to be prudent, affordable, sustainable, and in proportion to the size of the organisation. And other things being equal, if interest rates rises, that makes that judgment a bit more challenging.
Finally, as an organisation, we would like to see long-term and fair funding for authorities to allow them to plan strategically and remain financially stable. Even though the 2021 funding settlement was fairly generous, inflation's pretty much wiped out all of those increases. As our performance tracker report showed last year, funding has still not returned to pre-pandemic levels for most public services. So with that in mind, what would you like to see from the upcoming spring budget in March?
The spring budget, or budgets normally, they have tended in the past to be about the tax side of the public finances rather than the expenditure. Now, SIPFA and the sector have long argued, as your question suggests, about the need for long-term financial planning and financial planning certainty and sustainability. It's unlikely we're going to hear a little bit more or much more about that in this next budget, particularly as we're coming maybe towards the end of this parliament, and this government are unlikely to want to make commitments beyond the timing of the next general election. That said, if there are to be some announcements about maybe the taxation side of the public finances, a recognition the tax system as it affects local government is flawed and needs reform. Now, council tax and business rates are out of date. They're based on long outdated valuations. As I mentioned earlier on, the funding for social care reform has been short term in nature. So a commitment for fundamental review, which has been promised by this government on more than one occasion, and indeed was mentioned in the autumn statement, we'd want to see a commitment that that would happen the other side of an election. But if there are to be any announcements about funding for local services, we would hope that they would at least not let things deteriorate in the final year of this national administration. So if there's in the absence of a long-term settlement, further short-term funding to ensure things don't deteriorate in the short term probably would be something that we'd be looking for. And I guess the final thing to say is linking back to the very first question. I think in our view, it's no coincidence that the last time that council's reserves reduced was a time when the government introduced a four-year financial settlement to give councils planning certainty. And if the government are concerned about the level of reserves, one of the ways that they could solve that is actually commit to a longer term financial settlement for councils to enable them to plan. Because in the absence of that, they have to plan for the worst and hope for the best rather than plan on a more realistic basis. SIPFA's view is if the NHS can have a 10-year financial settlement and schools can have a 3-year financial settlement, surely local government and local public services should have the equivalent need or the equivalent security from that financial planning certainty.
Thanks, Andy. Thank you for your time on SIPFA Speaks.
Thank you. Good to speak to you.
That was Andy Burns, SIPFA's Associate Director, talking about SIPFA's Financial Resilience Index. That's all we've got time for on today's episode. To find out more about SIPFA's Financial Resilience Index, please visit SIPFA's website. The link will be in the show notes below. You can also follow us on social media for more and to make sure you never miss another episode. You can find previous episodes of SIPFA Speaks on our website or wherever you like to listen. Thank you very much for listening and goodbye.